Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Quick reminder about something you can do for do with us in about a half hour, because every Tuesday at noon, WNYC's politics website, It's a Free Country, hosts a live online chat. And we have a good one today. You'll get a chance to meet our brand new local politics blogger, Colby Hamilton. Colby will also be joined by an all-star cast here, fellow New York politics bloggers Ozzie Pabura of The Observer and Celeste Katz of The Daily News. I'll be in on this chat too today. Today's topic for Ozzie, Celeste, Colby, you and me is, after 6 months of the Cuomo administration, how different is life for New Yorkers? Is this, in fact, a historically transformational year for taxpayers and homeowners and for the social contract in general in New York State? We'll touch on gay marriage as well. Andrew Cuomo, it's 6 months. What's changed? How transformational? Join in on the live chat today at noon at itsafreecountry.org. And I'll remind you again as we get closer to the noon hour. By now, Americans are pretty familiar with the concept of debt, aren't we? Our grandparents experienced the Great Depression. We're dealing with a massive recession. We've witnessed Lehman Brothers collapse under the weight of bad debts, and we've seen homes taken away from lots of families. We've bailed out big banks, and we've watched smaller banks fall apart. We've experienced personal debt and federal debt, and right now we're waiting as our government debates defaulting or raising the debt ceiling. It seems like we know debt so well, but our next guest definitely knows it better. David Graeber teaches anthropology at Goldsmith College, University of London. He's the author of An Anthropological Look at the History of Debt. The book has a great title, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and it's out today. He also proposes a radical debt forgiveness scheme, which we'll hear. Professor Graeber, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much.
So should everyone just forgive everyone else's debt? Are you proposing something like that?
Well, I threw out the idea of something like a biblical jubilee really just to be provocative. It's not a policy book. It's more a historical and philosophical reflection. But I threw it out because I thought it's important for us not to think of debts as something sacred. We've come to this weird position where it's assumed that debt is just a promise, right? That certain types of promises are absolute, and you can't even imagine not paying a debt, whereas other types of promises are completely negotiable. And throughout human history, that's not been the case. Ordinarily, debts are considered just a promise like any other. And I think what we found out in 2008 is if you're powerful enough, that's still true.
Right. But what would life be like if we engaged in some kind of massive debt forgiveness, if we thought that we didn't really have to pay the mortgages and therefore be mindful of how much of a mortgage we were taking out, or, you know, that cash your sibling borrowed from you, if you weren't reasonably sure that that was going to get paid back because there was some kind of change in the social contract or our basic relationship with debt, which maybe is what you're implying here.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Again, there were – in the past, there used to be complete blanket cancellations, not of commercial debts but of consumer debts. That was a very common thing in the ancient world.
Why? Where?
Starting in Mesopotamia, actually – economist Michael Hudson actually makes the argument that interest-bearing loans were invented in ancient Mesopotamia, but it came along with the idea of periodic debt cancellations. And essentially what they've done is exported half the package. So, you know, for much of world history, it was assumed that periodically debts would get canceled, except, again, for debts between merchants. Commercial debts usually were kept. And there's no evidence that it destroyed economic life. In fact, it's usually when that didn't happen that you have terrible social problems, because there were certain periods of history where debts were considered sacred, and those tend to be periods where you have massive enslavement of large parts of the population, of debt peonage. You have war machines emerge from it, and massive social inequality and unrest. I mean, one thing I discovered which really surprised me is that most insurrections, rebellions, and revolutions in world history have specifically been about debt issues, much more so than people ever rebel about slavery or serfdom.
Such as?
If you look at the early history of ancient Athens or ancient Rome, from most of the constitutional changes which were created democracy to republican forms of government were actually reaction to debt riots, threatened rebellions or defections of the people. Same thing in Mesopotamia. Moses Finley, actually, the great classicist, actually said that there's basically one revolutionary program in all of antiquity, which is cancel the debts and redistribute the lands. That's it.
David Graeber, my guest on WNYC, who teaches anthropology at Goldsmith College, University of London, the author now of an anthropological look at the history of debt called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Did something happen 5,000 years ago that actually began the whole process of loaning and repaying when it didn't exist before?
Well, the invention of commercial money. One of the distinctions I make in the book is between human economies and commercial economies. In most societies known to anthropologists, the money is actually used mainly to rearrange social relations, marriages, funerals, settling disputes. It's only really in Mesopotamia you find the first signs of money sort of like what we're used to in the sense of something you can buy chickens with. On the other hand, what I discovered, which I thought was really striking, is when I started looking at that material about early uses of money, is that sort of conventional narrative we have of how money comes about. You know, first there was barter, that was inconvenient, then people invent money, then eventually there's credit systems, is actually backwards. In fact, credit systems come first. So for several thousand years, people were using elaborate systems of, you know, you go and put things on the tab. There's things like expense accounts.
Before there's cash money.
Before there's cash, yeah. I mean, the Sumerians didn't even make scales accurate enough to, like, weigh out the amounts of silver that would have been required to buy a chicken.
And you paid them back in the goods that you made?
Yeah.
Or your services?
Generally speaking, grain was acceptable or silver, but if you didn't have that, you can negotiate.
Is there any civilization or group of people that has successfully functioned without the concept of debt?
It seems, well, it depends on how you define it. If there's money, then there's debt. In a way, some people would argue that they're really the same thing. Societies without any form of money, sure. There's obligations. And in fact, the philosophical—
Well, any form of money. I mean, that's an interesting distinction that maybe is worth taking a minute on. Because if I walk into a store and I pay cash, that's not, by our usual way of looking at things, considered debt.
Indeed.
It would be debt if I paid with a credit card.
Yes. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating is just how much government policy it took to bring that about. For example, England, where, you know, this nation of shopkeepers, for much of English history, everybody walked into the shop and put things on the tab. In order to, for a while, in fact, a lot of the coins were being put out by shopkeepers. They were only used in that shop. It took years and years before they put out enough coins that it became possible for people to have enough small change to just go buy things.
Is there any culture that has successfully functioned with the concept of debt and didn't lose control over the whole system, as we seem to have here in recent years and have before at other times in our history?
Absolutely. I think that it was things like systematic periodic debt forgiveness which made it possible for Mesopotamian society to emerge and become quite wealthy by standards of the time. But I think the really interesting period to look at is the Middle Ages. Another thing that emerged when I was researching this book is that the Middle Ages looks a lot better than we're used to thinking. We think of it as this sort of dark ages. But in a way, that's because Europe was a very marginal place in much of the Middle Ages. If you look at what was going on in China, in India, in the Middle East at the time, what you have are very, very elaborate credit systems and very careful regulation. So, for example, China had markets much more developed than anything you see in Europe until maybe the 19th century. But at the same time, they were very, very carefully regulated. In Islam, on the other hand, they took exactly the opposite approach. They really were very suspicious of the government. So they had very elaborate credit systems which weren't enforced by the state at all. And it was all made possible by a ban on interest taking.
In your book, you argue that debt is unnecessarily tied to the idea of morality. We think all money lenders are evil and all debtors are shameful. And, of course, our literary characters enforce this idea. There's Scrooge from A Christmas Carol, Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life, Shylock from The Merchant of Venice. all pretty evil guys. Sometimes there's anti-Semitism wound up in this, too. And then there's the stereotype on the other end of the spectrum of the criminal who just refuses to pay back his debt. What's wrong with these characterizations?
Well, I think what it shows is what happens when you imagine life as a great marketplace. And you get this, it's reflected most of all, I think, in world religions, which emerge right around the same time as cash and personal markets. You have the situation where, insofar as people have ongoing economic relations, it's because somebody hasn't paid, and at least one party and probably both parties are seen as at fault. Words for sin and debt are actually the same in Sanskrit and Hebrew and Aramaic, most of the languages of the great religious texts. And one thing I find quite intriguing is the way that it creates almost this insoluble problem. Because people want to say, yes, morality is just paying your debts. Of course you have to pay your debts. Any decent person would. It's the only honorable thing to do. People who don't pay their debts are bad. But at the same time, moneylenders are always seen as evil. And almost all of the great religious works, when they start talking about morality, and the same is true of Plato's Republic, you know, they start by saying, what is morality? Morality is just paying your debt. And they say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't really work, does it? Well, maybe something else then. I mean, that's how Plato's Republic starts. That's Bible does the same thing. So they go from starting by saying, well, debts are a sacred obligation, to saying, well, maybe what's sacred is actually forgiving or erasing debts. Mm.
And in our last 30 seconds, you argue that the world today is at a sort of crucial point when it comes to debt. Maybe it's too obvious to even ask, because it's so all around us. But what is so significant in your view about the place that we're at now with respect to debt?
I think we're at the beginning of a new historical cycle, that we're returning to virtual money, which is the predominant form of money through much of human history. And we're not really prepared for that. We have antiquated ideas about what money is. So I think we're going back to a situation such as prevailed in much of the Middle Ages, where it was just understood that money is a social arrangement. It's an IOU. And social arrangements, by necessity, have to be periodically renegotiated.
David Graeber from Goldsmiths College, University of London. His new book is called Debt, The First 5,000 Years. Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Right now, we invite you to log on to WNYC.org for our latest BL slideshow. And we'll talk about these slides on the air here in a minute. You don't have to be looking at them to enjoy the radio show. But you can see all the submissions from artists and designers to our new Littles project to make a map of New York's new ethnic neighborhoods from Little Senegal to the new Italy, the new Little Italy. We'll meet four of the artists, and you can take a peek right now at these great new Littles maps at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.